Hey, welcome back to Rhetoric Warriors, the podcast. We are teaching 100 million Americans to persuade, counter-persuade, and de-persuade their fellow human beings. We're cleaning up American public discourse stream so people can think again. That's the idea, that if you save our public discourse channels, you can save America from itself. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So come on in and learn some stuff at a high enough level to make a difference when you actually go out to persuade politically. You can visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com. Find us on social media. I write jokes all day long on Twitter at Rhetoric War. You can follow those. My name is Dr. Dan. I am a rhetoric PhD, former professor, escaped professor from the universities. I was a comedy writer in late night Hollywood for a long time for late night talk. And I kind of got up into politics 5 years ago and started deciding to see what rhetoric can do to help us straighten out some of this stuff. So this podcast is set up. I talk to comedians. I talk to some experts. And I also try to convert right-wingers or Trumpies or MAGAs, whatever you want to call them, the far right, the GOP. I have guests on and we talk. And eventually I get the permission to try to convert them. And we'll see how that goes. My guest today is none of that right-wingy, but he is, I think, a very funny guy, a very funny comedian, known him for a long time. And he has some really interesting background in persuasion, I think, as an experiential thing that he's been doing for a career for a long time. So we're going to talk about that today. So everybody, welcome my guest today from Kentucky, directly from the blue grass state, Kirk Miller.
Kirk? How you doing, Dan? Howdy, Dan. How are you? Good to be with you. I'm particularly excited there's a evangelistic element to this podcast where you're trying to reach out and convert. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Don't you think the country's needing some conversion?
Yeah. Big slice of it.
Well, tell me what you think about that. What would you, what do you think needs to be converted these days?
In conversion?
What do you see?
Well, beyond the kind of the jokey implication that there's a religious element to your podcast, you know,
everything's evangelizing and proselytizing, right? All has a conversion element.
It is. And politics is intense in that way. And the two overlap, religion and politics. And, but you know, the issue of evangelicalness, is an interesting one. And is there a mandate to reach out and convert people to either to your religion or to your politics? And they're not dissimilar.
No, they aren't. Do you think there's a mandate? Do you feel any mandation?
No, but a lot of people do because they're told to and they believe it. I mean, the Bible, if you're going to read the Bible literally.
Like with your eyes?
Yes. As so many people claim to, there's multiple evangelistic mandates, i.e. you have a requirement if you're a Christian to try to convert other people, and you're not a true Christian if you hide it and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. Do you think to me, the far right does not actually do conversion. Like, they don't do persuasion. They do indoctrination, like at early ages, to get people lined up with their politics. They put pressure on families and things like that, but they don't actually persuade. They don't go out and do political conversion. They let their media do it for them. Whereas the left has to, you know, actively try to persuade. They have to talk to people, give reasons, take them through logical processes.
It just seems there's such a tenuous fiber between indoctrination and persuasion in that regard, because it almost becomes semantical. You know, does persuasion use different techniques than indoctrination?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, one of the splits that I create in Rhetoric Warriors is this idea of ethical only persuasion versus unethical dominated persuasion. And the right and indoctrination, manipulation, deception, slander, all of that is unethically dominated persuasion. Ethical only persuasion wouldn't allow any of those techniques to be used.
Okay, well, how about in days when there wasn't massive media throwing lies at people all the time as a point of method of indoctrination? But people were raising racist children that thought black people were inferior to them consistently. Were they being indoctrinated or persuaded?
That's Klan training. That's, you know, if you look at families and tribes, that's literally, it goes back to this clannishness about human social structures, that you trust the people within your clan group. And the easiest way to distinguish that, you know, is color. Like if somebody's from a different color, they're clearly not in your clan group. So you're supposed to fear them, hate them, fight them. You know, there's a huge tradition of that in human society down through all time. So this is nothing new. Like racism is just that kind of tribalism to me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was just trying to figure out the difference between it. You know, if I'm a right wing person, I look at education, textbooks with evolution in them as indoctrination. And of course, indoctrination has a heavy weight of negativity to it, you know, and persuasion is a positive, uplifting human way of doing things, is the implication I would think people would have in it. But as a liberal, I don't view that as indoctrination or persuasion. It's just education. So it adds even more.
It probably is education. It probably is persuasion, in that it has to be
persuasion to believe science. Persuasion to believe science.
It has to be presented in persuasive ways, which persuasion is things like you have freedom of choice about whether to believe this or not, but I have the burden to convince you. And if you're reading science, they take that burden very seriously. They don't just say, hey,
no, I understand.
Climate change, we're done.
Right. Now, you're going to the issue of should we accept people that are arguing lies? Yeah, I understand. They go against science, and no, we shouldn't. But I'm just saying where we are in society now in terms of the definition of those two words, you know, indoctrination and persuasion, we're split on even that.
Yeah, because we
don't agree on what indoctrination means.
Well, and that's part of the thing. Like, so one of the other unethical techniques that ends up confusing the whole landscape is appropriation.
Yes.
So you appropriate the other side's terms, their stories and their claims and their villains and all that kind of stuff, then you start saying that, like, it's clear the difference between indoctrination and persuasion. Like, no educated person would have a lot of difficulty seeing the difference in those two things. But the right has taken that word of indoctrination and they're applying it to education. And that's a misapplication of that term. So they've appropriated it, misapplying it, and it causes confusion. And then you have an unfunctioning public discourse.
They've appropriated Trumpism as democracy and Americanism as well. And so, yes, I understand.
That's amazing. Like, I love that stuff when I look at it, like they do the photoshopping of Trump into, you know, holding a gun on top of a hill with a flag. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, that's some amazing appropriation.
It is. I'll tell your listeners, there's a lot of upsides this pandemic. Oh, sure. There's death. There's overrun hospitals. There's nurses and doctors that are suffering terribly. People are without work. I got, lost my job, but I've been able to sit and watch a lot of news, including Fox News. So there's always an upside. And so I sit and luckily on my cable, those three channels of the three, I guess the indoctrination networks, you know, the CNN, Fox, and MSNBC are two persuasion, one indoctrination?
I would say CNN and MSNBC are persuasion channels. They are not indoctrination channels.
All right, I'll just play the position of 74 million plus people in the country.
I want to hear your views. I want to hear
I'm interested in what all views are and what other interests are. Here's my view is that my view is there's 74 million people that don't believe that shit whatsoever. I mean, they'll say, you know, CNN and anything but Fox and Newsmax is just pure lies and indoctrination. projection is the most powerful mechanism working right now, I think, to fuel the Trumpism that's going on. And all you have to do is listen to the language. Well, first of all, Trump makes it so easy, because all you have to do is listen to his what he says, and you know the opposite is true.
Right.
Or he's talking about something he did, not something someone else did. And I can go, you can listen to Fox and listen to his words, and he will give speeches regularly where 100% of it is that. And it gets mirrored immediately on Fox News. And I don't have to have a conversation online or in person with my Trump supporting friends to know what they think at that moment.
Right.
Because it now the mechanism implants so quickly and with such great, of course, it's faith is the other issue, but faith is required to allow the mind to get projected upon that quickly and rapidly and without question. And they're full of it, of faith. I don't mean
full of faith. They're over faith. Yeah. You know, I like that. I had that, I use that expression every once in a while. Oh, ye of too much faith.
Well, in a lot of regard, any is you got to be cautious of any feeling of faith, in a sense. You know, it's a wonderful thing to wallow in and to have as a recluse on Sunday, you know, enjoy it, whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. But when you start applying it outside of church, that's the problem. You start getting it out in my way, making decisions about my health care and my roads and my military and all that shit, and you're working against democracy at that point.
Hey, do me a favor. Do you have your banjo?
Sure do. You want
accessible?
Yeah.
I want to be able to tell people that I had the world's funniest, most political banjo, Kentuckian.
I have one banjo here. I have a bunch of banjos, but here's one.
Play us 30 seconds of your favorite banjo.
You know, I hardly play. Can you hear? Can you put yourself back into the mountains of Kentucky, Dan? That you left.
Yeah, I used to go to the Bluegrass Festival there in Louisville. You know, every summer, where they'd all come down from the mountains, watch the old toothless ladies play the dulcimer.
Yeah, I grew up going to the Bluegrass Festivals in Central Kentucky, Festival of the Bluegrass, and saw all those greats, Ricky Skaggs, when he was a 20-year-old, and New Grass Revival. You don't know who they are, I'm sure. Okay. They are an iconic, they were a modern bluegrass sound back in the 70s.
Yep.
Late 60s, 70s, when it got crossed over by Earl Scruggs, actually.
Hey, you know how you know that you're a legendary musician?
How's that?
When you can play the banjo and the washboard and people like it.
Now, see, there you go dissing the banjo again, and you've thrown another one in the washboard, which has a lot of benefit. If you can, I got some I can whip on you right now if you want to
pull out those spoons. I want
to
hear some.
It doesn't now. I'd have to go to the kitchen. I'm not going to do that. You know,
before we're done, you're going to play some spoons.
I think it okay. All right. Well, you played along with me. I'll go get some.
So take us back. Take everybody back to, because I think you have a really unique. You've lived your whole life in Kentucky in the South, and for the most part, but you've traveled everywhere.
Yes.
But tell everybody your background a little bit. Start with your dad and all that. I think it's really interesting.
The older I get, the more I appreciate it and cherish the fact that I was able to grow up in the family, you know, born into the family. I won the freaking lottery. I mean, you know, white male, middle-class family that thinks, you know, and questions stuff, you know, what more could you ask for? Now, dad was my name is Kirk because dad was born when he was in the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary here in Louisville.
Wow.
The word Kirk is the Scottish name for church. That's why I'm named Kirk.
Is that right?
Yes.
You are literally correct. Named Church.
That is correct. And we have Scottish ancestry. And so he put the two together, he and mom, and made Kirk. And they were full of the promise of becoming a preacher, you know, at that point. But what happened, he was actually, when I was born, the wheels were grinding and he was escaping a Southern fundamentalist, Southern Baptist upbringing. And he was raised by his mother. I tell some of these stories now, and they sound fantastical and unreal, but they're true. And I'm going to be writing a lot of this. I'm actually having to go down to Georgia and do some research. But my grandmother, when she died, so died the last active women's temperance union in the country. She was a notorious, documented in the Macon Telegraph newspaper, which is on microfiche now in Georgia, as being a raucous anti-liquor person in Macon, Georgia, to the point to where there are stories that my uncle, who's still alive, and aunt tell now, where they woke up when they were teenagers or younger in their house, and there was liquor bottles all strewn all across their yard. She also supported Black people and tried to help. She was a charity. She lived the Christian life, and she helped the Black. And that irritated the Klan, so they burned a cross right there in their yard in Macon, Georgia, years ago, per story. I wasn't there, but there's people alive now that have told me that, and it's in the newspaper, so that kind of gets it. I could go on about Laurel. That was my grandmother. She actually had a smoking machine in her basement made of, you know, glass tubes, and you'd put cigarettes in them and it would suck all the smoke into a bell jar. And she would take that to Sunday school camps and church camps and little, I saw it in use. I imagined it in use, but she would take it and light up and put some creature in that little bell jar and pump all the smoke while she was preaching to the kids about the dangers of smoking and how unchristian it was. Well, you know, the body's a temple.
Yeah.
And they would see that animal die. So he wound up coming to Kentucky. And then when he came to the seminary, it was a hotbed of liberal thought. This was in 57. It's not that now. This was before there was a famous theological split between that seminary and another one. And you know, it was before the moral majority and all that kind of crap started coming on the country. Mm-hmm. And so while he was at the Southern Baptist Seminary, he got interested in philosophy and he got a philosophy degree at UK. Long story short, he wound up preaching a little bit at some churches, but I became a university brat being moved around the country for his different college professorship jobs, till we landed in Kentucky at EKU and have been there, or that's where we stayed for quite a long time. So anyway, yeah, I had this, you know, Newt Gingrich was at West Georgia College, the same time my dad was teaching back in the late 60s. I remember, you know, going to sleep when I was a boy and there would be professors downstairs talking it up, you know, discussing issues and all that. So it was a vibrant, you know, philosophical family upbringing, you know.
That's fascinating to me as a kid that, you know, grew up in total working class with my dad was a general contractor, and he would have, you know, his best friends were an electrician, a mechanic, and a farmer. And they would come over and, you know, talk about their stuff for hours and hours and hours, but there was never any sharing in it. And there was no way to engage with them about it. Yeah. But to hear, like, just coming from that kind of background, even in the Deep South, or, you know, Kentucky's getting close to the South, at least, that, you know, there is an intellectual tradition.
We're just below the river. It's just, you can't really call us in the South right there. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting.
No, I had the Secretary of State of North Carolina, Rufus Edmondson, called me a Yankee once during a stand-up show because I was from Kentucky.
I had a lady in Northern Indiana one time come up to me. She said, "Oh, I'm from the South too." And I asked where. She goes, "Southern Indiana." I mean, you don't from the South. Anyway. Okay. So, yeah.
But that's great. So, you grew up with a family that had a heavy religious Baptist tradition,
yes,
but then added in philosophical,
yes,
thought.
Correct. And then he became the chairman of philosophy, and then he added a religion major to it over at EKU. So he was the chairman of the philosophy and religion department. And so there's a lot, you know, could be talked about the influence there, you know, that happened. But that I think one of the most interesting things about my background, when I think about it also, is that all of my family's like overeducated. Dad's PhD, mom was master's. All my siblings are college educated and some beyond, you know, and that kind of stuff. And again, I went to EKU Eastern so long they offered me tenure. So I quit, you know, I never got a degree. We can get back on a, you know, kind of a straight communication thing. Mine is just massive ADD. I have had, you know, incredible ADD since I was a boy. Luckily, I went through school at that time when they just passed the gregarious good-looking boys on.
Uh-huh.
Seriously, I would not be here. I would not have gotten out of high school. I'd be GED-ing it at the best, just because, even from that family influence, you know. But it just, my brain didn't work that way. But it's worked in a lot of, I hope I've put the scatteredness of it to.
Yeah, best use. I would describe you as a Kentucky Renaissance guy. Like, you have skills and interests across so many different things. Like, I've had meals at your house in your little apartment there that could have been, you know, at any high-end restaurant around the world.
Yeah. Well, and I don't cook. My children can cook circles around me. My son went to culinary school. So we got a big food culture here. Yeah, you know, again, that's just part of the benefit of ADD, where you're going to run out of things in life to do. So you just do different damn things, you know, look over there and it's fun over there, you know? And
you build musical instruments. So you do music.
I do.
You build bikes. Yeah. You got this whole, we need to get into that a little bit. Your politics about bike riding.
Oh yeah.
You're a learner. You're a comedian. You're a speaker. You know real estate. So
yeah,
there's a lot.
That's why I like this.
Sounds pretty Renaissance to me.
Yeah, well, thank you. I guess I guess Renaissance means would I have enjoyed the 14th century? Probably 15th.
Depends on what level you're at in that Renaissance. If you're still down in the muck, while they're Renaissancing way up in that building over there, it doesn't do you much good.
That's true. Well,
so tell me about
they'd have taken my ass to the tower, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah,
that's back in those days.
All right, so that's good. We got a good little background there. How y'all escaped the dungeons of pure on just religion.
Yeah.
Now you've got a lot of perspectives on that, right? I mean, you've seen the South, and you've seen all these things sort of percolate during your time. I imagine you were a hippie in the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. That got started, you know, growing up around college campuses. Last year was the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. It was also the 50th anniversary of me smoking pot because I smoked pot the first time when I was 12 years old in Carrollton, Georgia. During the week of Woodstock, we weren't there, but we knew it was going on. And I saw many of the greats in concert with a $4 festival seating ticket during the 60s, 68 to 71.
Like who? Who'd you see?
We saw the Allman Brothers before any of them died multiple times. We saw Steppenwolf. We saw Jefferson Airplane when Grace Lick was pregnant with God. You know, she named her child God. Many more. I grew up early, real early, down there in that 68 to 71 period, which was great. I liked it. And I was a hippie. Yeah, we rolled into Richmond 71. My hair was down at my shoulders at that point, you know, which was a prized thing for a, you know, fresh, you know, we were young. We were all pretty. But, you know, moving into a new place. And I wound up in Richmond, Kentucky, which is the most bizarre, interesting little town during the 70s than can be imagined. I'm actually writing a great deal about it right now, and with some crazy long memory posts on Facebook groups of Richmond that you should go check out, Dan, because there's rhetoric in them.
I would love to. There's rhetoric everywhere, Kirk.
Yes, there is.
So You were in Richmond. Tell me a little bit about that. Why do you say that it was such an exotic location at that time?
Richmond, if I could describe Richmond, Richmond was in the 70s a bootlegger with a flat tire on his truck. Richmond was a EKU student that signed up for 8 o'clock classes and failed them all because they never made it. Richmond was a city of townies and country people tenuously occupying the same plot of land on the plateau that is at the center of the bluegrass in Kentucky. And you had this mix of Appalachia. It was all the rage for New York kids to come down from Brooklyn and Queens and go to college at EKU at that point. So we had that mix put in there. And we had all the other cliche stuff that you can imagine about us. It was also there. The population was 19,000 when we moved there. And at a point there was 23 liquor stores, more than one per thousand population. And the reason was it was dry in Kentucky all the way south on I-75 and east in Kentucky. You could not get a legal drink of liquor unless you drove to Richmond. And that's why there were 23 liquor stores with bays and all the bootleg. And so it was a classic case of the moonshiners, the preachers, and the bootleggers working together to keep it dry in Eastern Kentucky, and Richmond benefited. So Richmond,
it wasn't, you wouldn't say what it wasn't. I mean, that, like, when you look at that stuff and the sort of underlying the true motivations within political work, that's a great one that you just said, like it literally benefited the bootleggers to have dry counties.
Sure. And the preachers and the moonshiners, they all had same interest. They had the same interest in the same end.
Right.
They had interest in the same end. They just didn't have the similar interest, you know, different motivations. So
they're all feeding off the same trough, just at a different, you know, place.
And people say we don't have a complicated society here in Kentucky. By God, there's an example right there. See the complexity of the world? It's just like walking through Queens. By God, it's just that complicated. You know,
yeah, the there's nothing. There's no human culture that's ever simple.
Correct. No, that's right. That's why I get my ire up, because I love Kentucky so much. And people, you know, you know, when you own a spot, you get defensive about it. And it's more fun and easy to, you know, see the hillbilly nature. You know who started all this shit, don't you? Of making America think that Kentucky was hillbillies?
Deliverance?
Walt Disney. And it was with one cartoon that came out in the 30s. Remember the hillbillies fighting each other to the sound of the where they fight each other all over the bridge and beating each other? That was America's first exposure to hillbillies.
Yeah.
And then it got associated with Kentucky. And there's other history that goes along with that. So the culture, the rhetoric, the words that have come out of Kentucky from writers and other artists are immeasurable. I mean, it's just, you know, if you're just looking at that aspect of life, you know, too.
Yeah, so, when it percolates up into that general culture, and you saw this a couple years ago when I remember the woman clerk, wherever she was Kentucky, yeah. And she wouldn't sign the marriage certificates for gay guys or gay and lesbian couples. And every single time that was mentioned in the media, they said such and such from Kentucky, this Kentucky clerk, they made sure they got Kentucky in there.
Oh, and we got our ambassador, Mitch McConnell. That, you know, he's not the best example of a human species. You know, let's not use him up as a measuring stick for success, you know, as a human. But
well, the only way to break into the general culture is to either be, you know, like from someplace like Kentucky, is to either be a superhero or a supervillain, you know. And so those are the only Kentuckians that ever make it out, like Muhammad Ali, Hunter S. Thompson. You know, people don't even know Ali and Thompson were from Kentucky, because it's
I think a lot of them know a lot of them know Ali was now.
Well, after, you know, because
more after Jeff, of his, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, beginning of his career, he would say the Louisville lip and, you know, all that. Yeah, but that faded once he got to a certain level of fame. Right. You know, nobody knew that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. There's that's my point. There's more people that will belie your clichéic idea of what Kentucky is. Now, let me – listen. Do we keep elect – do we have a – are we red as hell? Yes. Do we have a lot of people that have learned things once and then just stopped? Yes. You know, they're all over this state. It's like they're over everywhere. We just have a – we're just tipping. I could live long enough to see us turn into a blue state just like Georgia did. I never would have thought Georgia would have made that.
Well, it's not Georgia. It's Atlanta.
Well, right. And they have the history going back to Jimmy Carter, you know, that kind of stuff. But still I'm, you know, there's persuasion going on here in Kentucky.
And I, you know, when you talk about my, you know, feelings about Kentucky, I don't really have, you know, broad cultural conclusions about Kentucky. My conclusions are, you know, the things about Kentucky that I don't like, the sort of, that you can find, you know, you talk about the split between rural and city, which still is the determinant factor in explaining our politics. You know, Biden just won 27% of the counties, you know, and basically, you know, landslide because of cities. And so the problem I had with growing up was I was a learner. I was a kid who liked to read. I came from a smart family. You know, it was a very work-class family. I was the first person to go to college, but my vocabulary grew, you know, because I was reading. And when you're abridging your vocabulary when you're like seven because the adults aren't getting it, then you don't fit in that culture.
Right. Yeah.
If I'd grown up in your family, that wouldn't have been a problem.
Luckily, since I couldn't read well, they were taught I was getting it verbally.
Yeah.
I was getting it verbally because I didn't read books. I think I read Animal Farm in high school. That was all I can remember. Reading. Yeah. No, it's interesting. And the political side of this too,
and you've seen a lot of this. So I'm interested in this too. Like, you know, I really appreciate you talking about your background like that. Cause it does expands the story of how people think about Kentucky and I've always gotten it. I've always had a soft spot in my heart in some ways for Kentucky, but your politics, you've been looking at politics for a long time. And I remember you talking to me about the Tea Party way back when I hadn't even really heard of the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. But you've watched a lot of this happen, you know, the sort of rise of the moral majority. And I track it all the way back to McCarthy because I'm tracking rhetorical techniques and McCarthy's slanderism and that kind of, you know, all that Nixon used. And then it just, you know, has been repurposed by Trump. But you watched this emerge. So talk about that a little bit. When did you start seeing this? And tell me some stories about that.
Well, it is when you think about it, it is the intersection of religion and politics, because, you know, that was what years were the moral majority coming in? They were
it was the 80s.
80s, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. So long before that. Yeah.
Contract with America was Clinton, 85.
It just goes back to your parents. I mean, dad and mom were making us aware of what was going on in the 60s. And dad was the one on the student's side, you know, like he'd be the student advisor in the conflict, the 60s conflicts on the campus, you know, and he was, you know, and he always, you know, said there's all kinds of intelligence and don't judge people. It's funny, if I could slip this in and you could remind me what we were talking about, because I'll lose my train of thought, but you were talking about how you grew up around the mechanics and the people that, you know, the different kind of people, the you know,
working class,
blue collar working class kind of people. See, I did too. And farming people, this was another one of the blessings of the upbringing is that dad was a first preaching gig was at a country church over in Woodford County. And we went to these people's houses with, you know, without houses, you know, and these country people that worked. I eventually wound up working with my hands out of high school because I couldn't do anything intellectually. So I was a welder and all that kind of stuff. And so I have a more than a deep appreciation for people that don't get the benefit of, you know, the educational background, you know, anyway, I just want to throw that in. Now, what were we talking about before? We're talking about
The rise of the Tea Party and that kind of,
oh, the Tea Party and all that kind of stuff.
Experiencing that. Like, what was that like to experience? Cause I think it moves past most people and they didn't really experience it, but I remember you noticing it. I specifically remember you telling me about it.
Okay. Cause we've been noticing this kind of stuff. Of course. So you go back before, go to Nixon. Okay. And start looking at the influence of Billy Graham.
Yep.
Dad used to, he used to swear or make fun, not swear, he'd make fun. He'd get mad, really. But he'd be sarcastically making fun of Billy Graham, saying, there he is on Johnny Carson in his $300 suit. That was a lot of money back then.
Uh-huh.
And it was him. And what Dad was reacting to was this shift of religion becoming what it was. And it was becoming this, you know, useful mechanism all the way to the White House, because that was when he was becoming the preacher to the, president, but also he's going on Johnny Carson, you know, and you know, and so it was that was where, so I had that feedback, you know, coming in, but we were always being made aware of political issues, and it was it was all around, you know, it was being talked about in the House and that kind of stuff. I remember Nixon, there was this great political science professor at Eastern Kentucky University named Klaus Heberle, which I put a post about him on a Facebook memory page, and just tons of people have flooded back saying, oh yeah, he was great. You know, he was one of the great teachers there. He was, but I was sitting in my dad's office right down the hall from his. It was like 3 days after the news came out in the Wall Street or whatever, the newspapers about the break-in at Watergate. And, you know, it's like 2 days later, cause you had to wait for the newspaper, you know, to get to, you know, just a little bit thing. And Klaus Heberle walked in Dad's office, and I was sitting there after school, and he goes, Nixon's involved in this.
Uh-huh.
And it was what, 2 years later, you know, whatever. So I think back at that, well, of course I've been political. I've been around all these adults all my life that were thinking politically and pushing stuff. So yeah, the hippie. So growing up a young little hippie in a liberal household.
Yeah. So, you know, we talked earlier about the difference between indoctrination and persuasion.
Yeah.
Really, the difference here is indoctrination and exposure. Like, you were exposed to this stuff, but they weren't sitting there, you know, punishing you or rewarding you or jamming it into your brain. You could make a choice. That to me,
totally.
You know, indoctrination doesn't give you that choice.
I have one of my sisters has made her purchase in life, her living as a music minister in churches in California. She's a minister. My brother and I don't attend church, to put it mildly. We approach it in a different way, you know, and all of that was rewarded when we were kids. I remember we could make the decision early on not to go to church. We didn't want to. Early on meaning, you know, teens,
right?
Which most Southern Baptists, you know, usually the rule is, till you're out of my house, by God, you go get church
at least
once a week, you know, that kind of stuff. So now we didn't have kind of indoctrination, you know. So
yeah, you were exposed, but and allowed to choose.
Exposed, correct. That's right. And then the moral majority and all that kind of stuff started coming on. And that was it was hilarious. I have books on my shelf that Dad gave me. He's got one. What was Jim Baker's? Tammy Faye Baker. He gave me a Tammy Faye Baker wrote about herself 1 year for Christmas.
Yeah, but you know, the difference back then, and I tell people the difference between that stuff then and now, is back then those people were pretty clumsy. You know, the Jim Baker level, kind of like Tammy Faye Baker looked like a clown, and Jimmy Swagger sounded like a clown.
To you, right. I did.
But it was still theatrical to the point where the broader culture would recognize it pretty quickly as this kind of scammy, you know, sham bullshit. You compare that to Joel.
Yeah, Dan, your use of the term the broader culture is becoming problematic, but go ahead.
Well, compare, like what I'm saying is just when you take that outside of evangelical communities and you start to expose people outside of that community, they may still be Christian, but they didn't grow up in an evangelical tradition. Right. Then you have to up the theatrical game. So you get Joel Osteen's, who is now in a suit and is well spoken and is a businessman. basically mm-hmm. talking, you know, God. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. a whole new level of outreach that, you know, you don't get from the Tammy Faye Bakers, because they're going to convert some people. But in order to spread that, you know, you have to have other characters. You have to take on other mm-hmm. costuming and other rhetorics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see that. To me, that was the evolution away from, I grew up, half my family was Baptist. It was at my grandmother's house, and she would watch Jimmy Swaggart and send him money and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And even as a kid, I'd be like, this guy's a clown.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But you can't do that with Joel Osteen. Like, he sounds yeah. educated. He sounds.
Right. Comes in the middle. Right. Right. Well, you're making me think, and it's just media that did it. I mean, you know, media that needed media, and then it had a willing audience, then there's a slot to fill it. You know, there's just like, you know, Trump being elected. I mean, it's the same thing. There were different methods of how religion started shifting into politics. That was a big one. That was a monumental period. But also, what people that aren't involved in the church don't understand was when the modern church started coming in, the mega churches, the early, you know, like a good example is Southeast Christian Church here in Louisville, that the sanctuary seats 10,400 people. And it's been around now 20 something years in that sanctuary. But it was when they started to modern it up mm-hmm. and started to add the different music. Of course, this is how my sister's made her living. She's an incredible musician, and she jumped right on that. Her husband was a Christian, was a professional drummer in a wildly popular Christian band out in California back in the 70s and 80s, or maybe the 80s, I guess. I'm making everybody too old. But that was another it was an evolutionary thing, but it was also an outreach, and it was a creep toward planting religion in the now and in the cultural now.
Right.
Which can be problematic.
Well, and what I'm saying is, like, they start to shear away the traditional aesthetics of religion, like the big hair and the makeup and all that. So you saw that go away with
yeah. Tammy Faye.
Then you got right. to Joel Osteen, who is still in a church, still talking, you know, with God terms and with Bible and stuff yeah. like that. And then yeah. Fox comes along, Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh is a preacher. He right. just doesn't say God that much.
That's right.
Exact same sound, exact same, you know, fire and brimstone, big villains, all that kind of stuff. So they've just sheared away things that let people recognize that this is evangelical or extreme religion, to the point where they've now got all the emotional effects of the religion without having to talk about it as a religion. And that's what becomes the far right politics.
Yeah, they're just bleeding it over. They've obviously abandoned the Beatitudes yeah. in their preaching and their actions. You know,
yeah, there's no contemplative, you know, apologist. No. There's no, yeah, august.
I mean, for those of people, don't, yeah, yeah. If you don't know what the Beatitudes are, that's blessed are the poor, blessed are the weak. You know, it's those things that well, for your Catholic. Listening, for your listening audiences.
Okay, sorry.
The greatest irony in the last election, to meld this to politics, religion, politics, is just amazing. Again, if you were from the, you know, 2,000-year-old religion of Christianity, you would understand the Beatitudes as the essence of what Jesus was trying to get across, if, you know, or whoever this guy was they called you, or whatever they pot you, whatever that whole story was. And Bernie Sanders, the most... he was a devout, he says, I don't going to tell you my religion. You know, he didn't wear it on his sleeve. You know, he's implied he didn't believe in God, but his policy positions in politics line up identical to the Beatitudes. If you read them, what he wants to do is fulfill the message of Jesus, and all of the other candidates had Jesus just, you know, clinging to their shoulders with desperate fingers and putting out policies that would do absolutely the opposite.
Right. But literally, go back to rhetoric. So what rhetoric looks at is essentially the most powerful thing is the scan level symbols. So the fact that, you know, the right can come up there and act like horrible, horrible human beings, but claim to be Christians. the claim is what's important. You know, the fact that they wear a suit, that they're the right color, that they don't swear, you know, these kind of things are the big, easy symbols to read. And that becomes dominant in a lot of ways when you're starting to do big outreach and big, you know, herd growing. So when you see somebody like Bernie Sanders, I've seen a lot of this try to come up into the Democratic Party these days, where they're trying to recapture the fact that, hey, we're far more Christian and Jesus-like than the right.
Well, I was appropriating that, but I hadn't heard the Democratic Party claim that. I was saying that the irony
was
that...
That's the thing. They won't come out and say that.
No, but Bernie... I just saw that piece of irony, that Bernie's policy positions, if enacted, were more in line with the Beatitudes and the spirit of Jesus than any of the other people were. I don't know that there's any, if I said that to Bernie Sanders, he'd go, oh, okay, I understand. I get it, but whatever. And he'd go on, you know, I mean, that's
but how much more, how
he's
much
not trying to do that.
Would he get if he said, look, I'm the most Jesus adherent.
He ain't gonna do that.
Politician.
But then now you've gone. See, now you're suggesting what is tipping us to a potential downfall of the democracy is that we're letting that rhetoric, you know, which obviously would not be true. I mean, you know, I mean, I understand bedside conversions and, you know, and all that kind of shit, and the altar call and older people, that can happen. It ain't gonna happen to Bernie Sanders. That's just not gonna happen. He's not gonna show up at a Southern Baptist church and hear the call and come down weeping and say, I now believe in Jesus Christ as my savior. That's just not going to happen.
My point is, but my point is this. So if you're doing rhetoric and you realize, okay, these people have been dominated by Christianity their whole lives, they cannot get it out of their system, out of their brains. If you're not using some of that to help them understand your positions and why you are more Jesus-like, then you're giving up a rhetorical advantage you don't need to give up.
No, I understand. If it's not right, should it be pointed out? Yes. You know, if you're talking with, if I'm having a discussion with someone who is really arguing.
You
ought
to have a Jesus impersonator standing next to him and going, uh-huh, that's right, Bernie.
That's it.
Yeah, baby.
That's it. It doesn't even need to be a puppet. Just put a mask on. And they know
some guy walks around, you know, as Jesus all the time. He always shows up with Bernie.
And he's like, he's behind Bernie going, this guy right here.
Yeah.
Right here. This guy. This
316 guy right all day.
That's it. That's what he'd say. Jesus would be going, check his hands. But there's holes in them.
All right. Well, that's fascinating. So I want to touch a little bit on your other stuff now, because you've made your living, you know, in something that I've worked in off and on for the last few years, 5 or 7 years in business. Doing, I've done a marketing agency and have tried to adapt a lot of my stuff so that it's useful to business. You've been out there selling real estate and now training people to real estate. And to me, that's, you know, that's one of the very niche forms of persuasion in our culture that everybody experiences at some point, right? Mm-hmm. You always buy or sell or whatever a house. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. You've been in that stuff for a long time. Tell people what your background is.
Well, it is a business of rhetoric. Just real quick, I got licensed as a real estate agent back in 82 or 83. I forget. It was right when interest rates were like 100%. But anyway, sold real estate, managed real estate offices, had a little part ownership for a while in a real estate office, trained realtors. But what happened is I got hooked up with Century 21, and I had a propensity for platform work, training, standing up speaking. So I got in the 90s, I started just getting on airplanes and flying around the country and staying in Marriott's and eating the $25 breakfast and getting up and going into the ballroom. And I would talk to either, you know, 20 or 1,000 people about one of two things. Either if it was an audience of sales associates, it's how to become more successful sales associate. Different techniques, rhetoric, lines to say, words to use in certain situations. Those were the things that I taught, as well as other issues, you know, motivation and that kind of stuff, how to keep things going. And then also the broker owners of the residential real estate offices, you know, like a Century 21 franchisee, or later in life, a Weikert franchisee or any of those, do you think of ERA, you know, that kind of stuff. So you had business owners, then you had real estate agents, and you said it right. You talk about a niche. There have probably been 10 people, 15 people, perhaps, in the country that have had the same pattern of experience that I've had in doing that, you know, and teaching to real estate brokers. So yeah, I've been all over that. It's been wonderful. It's taught me what the country is. It's taught me humility again, because the more you travel, the more you find out you don't know crap, you know, about what people think until you, you know, talk to them. And I've learned that Southern, you may have noticed a Southern, a little bit of a Southern drawl in my, my voice. I've learned that that works. You have to imagine I'm standing up in front of groups that have never heard me before in a lot of cases. And Southern works anywhere in the country. If there's something smart coming out of your mouth.
Right.
Northern doesn't work that way. You take your Yankee accent down to Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, you can be smarter than Einstein, and they're going to tell you to get your, you know, it's psychological. Anyway, now Atlanta's changing. I get that. So anyway, so yeah, I've had that experience. It's been, it's wonderful to put rhetoric into action. I've been able to help a lot of people with their lives. You know,
you're just a traveling real estate rhetorician.
That is exactly what I did for 30 years. That's correct. And it's good work if you can get it.
Yeah, I've seen you do this. Like I came up and you hired me for you a couple of times in New York, and then I watched you do your thing, and I'm like, hey, this guy knows what he's doing. Look at that.
We were at a casino, weren't we?
Yeah, and
Foxwoods. Yeah, Foxwoods up in Connecticut. That's right. Yeah. I tell you, they run together. So 48 states is how many I've spoken in. I haven't been to North Dakota or Alaska.
You know, that's an amazing amount of reach. You've been doing that for 30 years. You know, the amount of people that you've talked to, the amount of actual rhetoric instruction you have given out to the world, far mm-hmm. greater than all these academic rhetoricians that I know who've written books and everything else.
It's very possible.
No, yes. It's absolutely true. You're in the trenches. They're teaching 20, 25 students at a time, sometimes big classes, but
one
semester.
We were mass communicating, as that guy says on, what was it? Oh, brother, where art thou? We on mass communicating.
Mass communicating.
Oh, it is funny. We, you know, how do you transmit your rhetoric and persuasion to people? And that's been another interesting thing in my period of life is that, you know, we've really gone from newspapers, 3 channels, 4 plus TV, if you count PBS, on TV and radio, you know, all analog, through what we have now, you know, bombarding us with the possibility of information, you know, and how is that going to be, how is that on a daily basis becoming reckoned with, and, you know, what's it doing to, it's fascinating as hell to me. I mean,
well, the whole world is now experiencing the inside of your brain, the ADD
experience. Yes, yes, yes. And it's calming to me. It's calming to me is what's interesting about it. You know, you seen the social network?
Yeah.
That I haven't watched all of it. I saw part of it. And I'm going, well, that's not news. What the fuck? I've known that. Who doesn't know that's going on was my thought.
Right.
And who doesn't know that's affecting their brain? I mean, you got to think about everything that's happening. If you know that's going on to your brain, you can just stop it. It's like a switch. If you know what's happening to you, all it takes is 100% skepticism whenever you go online. That's all it takes. And it doesn't take a ton of effort. It's really easy. You can flow right through it. It's easy. You just look at that. No, that's not true. Let me think.
I like it. That's a nice little rhetoric counter programming, 100% skepticism all the time.
Correct. And then that really doesn't work when you think about it.
Well, you know, when good persuaders run into skepticisms, they know how to work. They know how to work through it.
Yeah.
Well, do me a favor and get your spoons or play some more banjo. I want to be able to say somebody played the spoons.
Hang on. Let me, all right. Hang on a minute.
I'm going to keep talking while you're gone.
You got your
microphone on, right? You can keep talking.
Yes, I do. I can't hear you, but maybe you can hear. Let's see.
there's your musical orchestra right there. Your utensils.
There.
You gotta be fascinated by, you know, just country music, just the way people turn everything into music.
Could you hear that?
I can hear some spoons.
Could you hear them all rattling in there?
I could. Yep.
Do you know how to play spoons?
No, I don't know how to play the spoons.
It's very simple. Well, let's turn this into an educational opportunity for everybody.
I just want to hear you play your favorite spoon.
I'm going
song.
To, but see, they're a basic rhythm, right?
I'm losing you when you're down low. I can hear you on your hands.
I don't do this every day. Can you hear it?
Just barely. You're getting out of your microphone range.
Well, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Play it on your stomach right by your microphone.
Well, you can't play it on your stomach. You have to see, this is why you need to understand things, Dan.
Okay. You teach me.
You have to hold them barely apart. So when they come together, they go apart. And then you got to use this like remember the washboard you were dissing a little earlier where you're talking about the washboard's dumb or something? Okay, well, no, because there's a washboard. You need that to make the bounce.
I gotcha.
See, you're making it bounce that way. You can't do it here. That's just dumb. You know, ham bone is, right?
Yeah.
You know, ham bone, that's ham.
Yeah, yeah.
Hands.
Sure, yeah. Of course I do. Of course, so, they wouldn't let me out of Kentucky without knowing ham bone.
Yeah, well, yeah, I needed these skills to.
Did you pick up Kentucky girls? You play some spoons at the bar late?
Yeah.
Like, it's just like a siren's call.
It is. It's like hearing the wolves in the mountains. They hear it and it just gets there. You know what they do? When they hear me playing the spoons, they take their hand knitted book covered Bible and slip it under the bed because their thoughts are, you know,
yeah, they don't want Jesus to hear what's going to be happening next.
That's right. We got some spoons howling out there, baby. Something could happen.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's do just a few more minutes. The last thing we haven't covered is your comedy career. Why don't you do some comedy? Talk some comedy for the people.
I tell you, I was so lucky because my career had already failed before the pandemic, so I didn't have that problem that a lot of my friends are having. And you know, Dan, because you made an appearance, I'm in the middle of doing a Zoom series called the Shortest Banjo Podcast Ever, the COVID edition, and we're interviewing super legit stand-up comics from all over the country. Some people, TV cred, and there's these people, a lot of different various backgrounds. Some people that are just, you know, 10 years into comedy, some are in comedy 30 years, and talking about the impact that it's had on their lives. And it's, we'll let everybody know when that's ready to drop. That's interesting
I'll promote you.
Well, my stand-up was, I remember, one time I slipped out the Comedy Caravan back when I was married, coming back from a meeting. And I just slipped in there for an open mic night just for some reason, because I'd always wanted to do it. So I was I 50 by then? No, my middle 40s by then. And just no laughs. I mean, you know, nothing happened. And then years later, because I didn't know what it was. I just, you know, I didn't know what it was. I think the first time I stepped foot in a comedy club. No, I'd been in a few before then. But anyway, so I guess, what was that, 13 years ago or so, approximately 12, 13 years ago. That's around when I met you, I guess. There's just an amazingly vibrant stand-up community here in Louisville, as you know, Dan, has been for years. Iconic comedy club here.
That's where I started. That's right.
I'm telling you. And it's still continuing. There's more venues that have opened up, and you know, we're net more now as just comedy venues than we ever have been. But anyway, so I got interested in it, and You know, I honestly, a lot of my motivation was Dad's high ideals of comedy and all that kind of stuff. Just, you know, what I'd been, you know, worked into. And then went back to it after I got divorced and was hanging out, and I enjoyed it.
All right, well, you got 3 minutes. Let's hear some jokes.
I ain't telling no jokes.
Tell me a couple of your jokes.
They were all, I can tell a story.
Yeah, you're a one-liner comic. You have a lot of...
Here's one. But I think this is a bonus story as well.
All right.
I mean, this is when Dan wrote a lot of jokes for me. This is not one of them, but Dan wrote a lot of jokes, but it was during that period of time. I remember Sogol had me out for another gig, and I was coming in on Friday. I was going to be the host for all the shows that weekend. And I pulled up to the comedy caravan, and there was two buses sitting out there. And I'm going, hot damn, we're going to be packed when I go in there. So I came running in there, and sure enough, the place was to the gills filled with people. Average age was about 132. It was a World War II reunion of guys.
Yeah, I did that show.
Was that you?
Yeah, I did that show.
Was that when I got up there? I thought, now what would get them really laughing? And I got up there. Well, you probably weren't even in the room. You're upstairs waiting to come on. I got up and I said, you know, I thought, well, what could be something that I could connect with them on? And I changed up my opening joke. And I decided I'd get up there, and I started this way. I said, guys, and I, you know, hey, how you doing? I welcome them. We were talking about their service and how much we appreciate it and all that kind of stuff, you know, talking to a couple guys. And I said, I wrote a book about my service during the Vietnam War. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called A Guide to the Bars and Taverns of Winnipeg. And it turned out to be an inappropriate joke at that moment. And I think it kind of encapsulates my comedy career, because it really got to where so much of I was using it as a stupid, actually, I was using it the wrong way, because I was using it as a stupid escape from actually thinking, because it was basically just, you know, Richard jokes. And after a while, people were still laughing and I wasn't. And I, you know, and so I just kind of got tired of it. And
tell them the Hitler joke. What was the Hitler joke? I'm sorry. Remember the Hitler joke? What was that one?
The Hitler joke. Oh God, there was.
Remember?
I told.
Hey, you hit your microphone. You're scratching your microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, which? Give me a.
Well, I don't want to give away the punchline. I'm trying to lead you to the joke. You know, it would have been just as sad if Hitler had rounded.
That's right. It would have been just as sad. That's a good bit. It would have been just as sad, but it'd been a whole lot funnier if Hitler had rounded up the midgets. And it'd be, what was it? Yeah. This meant you got to be that tall. What were some other punches? Hell, we had
that train. That train would have been the little engine that could.
Yeah, the train. And the sounds of the train wafting through the German countryside, the Aryan workers would hear the sound of "We represent the Lollipop Guild" as the train rolls through. Just horrible stuff like that, you know.
But you had the best tag on it. What was the tag?
I can't remember.
It wouldn't have been called.
Oh, that's right. It's the smaller cost. Yes. I forgot. I'm enjoying these jokes again because I forgot.
Great tag. I love that tag.
That was.
Yeah, the reason why I remember doing that World War II show,
yeah,
it was Army, I don't know, the Second Army or something, you know, and they got together every year, right? And all the wives and everything else. And a lot of them had died by that point.
Yes.
And I remember talking to them about it.
That night in the audience. A couple of them
probably. They had a coffin, you know, in the back just in case. And I was talking to them because I love to do crowd work, and I was fascinated by these people. And so I was talking to this one woman, Agnes, whose husband had died a few years before. And she asked me, well, what branch did you serve in? And I said, I was never in the military. And she called me a coward. She's like, you're a coward. Yeah. I'm like, damn, that escalated quickly.
they were in their fervor because they were having a reunion. She wouldn't have said that if you just saw her at church, you know.
I'm like, you don't have a lot of categories there, Agnes. Either you're a patriot or you're a goddamn coward.
Coward, that's right. Well, life is binary.
That's easier when it is, that's for sure.
That's what I was going to say. I agree.
Well, Kirk, I appreciate it very much, man. You're an interesting dude. You got a lot of good life experiences. I've always admired you for the way you approach the world.
Thanks.
Appreciate you talking about it.
Mutual. Let's talk again.
All right. Sounds good, buddy.
Peace.
See you.
See you.